dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio on W201 CD or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
I know good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time.
According to a study released last week by the Paris-based NGO Reporters Without Borders, the United States ranks number 17 for press freedom. Out of 139 countries surveyed, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and the Netherlands tied for the top spot. They were followed by Canada, Ireland, Germany, Portugal, Sweden, and Denmark. The U.S. received its relatively low ranking in part due to arrests of reporters for failing to reveal their sources or, since the September 11th terrorist attacks, for crossing security lines at some official buildings. In the past year, the administration of George W. Bush has also pressed media outlets not to run unedited videos or transcripts of al-Qaeda leaders, while military commanders in Afghanistan have restricted the movements of reporters there and, in at least one case, threatened a newspaper correspondent, according to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists. But direct government repression of the press is not the greatest threat Americans face. The principle and practice of a free press that can allow the citizenry to scrutinize government's performance is most frequently undermined by press outlets themselves that uncritically channel the highly managed pronouncements of officialdom. These media outlets frequently have close ties to interests that profit from official policy, and they actively participate in shaping public opinion through their editorial choices, all the while claiming to be objective. Tonight on the program, we'll explore the propaganda methods being used to create public support for war. We'll begin with part one of a documentary series from Radio Netherlands, The War of Words. Then, The Fire This Time, a documentary from the UK on the 1991 Gulf War and Iraq sanctions that was produced by two British journalists in response to media self-censorship there.
Radio Netherlands presents The Producers, Governments and Information in Times of Conflict, Part 1 of the Sound Fountain series, War of Words. The program was compiled and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
And we, the democracies of this world,
we will use whatever means are necessary to achieve our objectives.
Propaganda is one of the oldest weapons of war. Words and images which appeal to people's darkest fears and secret hopes. Words and images which may allow them to shed their humanity and join in the slaughter of a foe. The world's democracies have brought propaganda to its highest form. A system which relies on majority consent develops sophisticated methods for achieving it. Today in The Producers, from Geneva, Johan Galtung, the father of peace studies. From Amsterdam, Sees Hamelink, professor of international communications. From New York, Steve Rendall of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. From London, Peter Noorlander, campaigner for free speech with Article 19. And also from London, Alan Davis of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
propaganda doesn't have to be Goebbels trying to demonize the Jews in Germany and having the rats run along the sewers and stuff like that. It doesn't have to be as blatant and as crude as that. Propaganda can take many insidious forms, and so we just actually have to be much more aware of terminology, of language being used.
Saddam Hussein is a homicidal dictator who is addicted to weapons of mass destruction.
And Bush, the Satan, has perpetrated his crime.
Al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime will be eager to spread false propaganda.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
In the name of Allah, most merciful and compassionate.
May God bless America.
Whereas, let's say in the Second World War, you had a little department of 10, 11 people, and they sort of made it up as they went along. Now you have huge, great organizations, consultancy or pressure groups formed to actually try and influence public opinion, trying to influence television coverage.
The oldest technique of propaganda is just simply lying. That's what's usually called black propaganda.
Professor Sees Hammerling.
That has been decreasingly popular because it's a bit too easy to find out. So a much more refined technique, which is much more often used, and which was widely used, for example, during the Gulf War, is grey propaganda, which means that you lie a little bit, but you also combine it with the truth. You find sort of a combination of these two elements. That is usually fairly effective because there is a point of reference in reality where people can say, yes, you know, but this happened. But then you combine it with something which is not true. That's a classical technique which is very often used nowadays. Of course, another technique which is widely used is just the way in which you employ language. You make things sound not as dangerous as they might otherwise sound. Like, for example, no, you don't talk about the battlefield, but you talk about a theater. And you don't talk about, you know, bombing people into oblivion, but you talk about laying down a carpet. So you make it look like as if, you know, it's almost like gentle. Another classical technique which has happened, you know, over the past years quite regularly is character assassination. You describe the enemy as the most evil person, as totally inhuman. You dehumanize the your opponent. You make Saddam Hussein into a Hitler. You call Milosevic a Hitler. You make just everyone a Hitler whom you don't like. You know, that's usually fairly effective as well.
The dictator is a student of Stalin.
I think that there is a kind of a pattern which comes up again and again, which is very simple, and it is the formula behind all propaganda.
Peace activist Johan Galtung.
Try to make people believe there are only two parties. Don't make it complicated. And in this there is an enormous contempt for people.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
Point out very clearly who are the baddies and who are the goodies. So who are the good ones and who are the evil ones. And point three, make it look as if a battle is inevitable, that there can be no other way than violence.
The great battle has been initiated, the mother of all battles, between the triumphant truth with the support of God and the evil pushed by Satan, which will be beaten eventually, God willing.
And I call that a DMA pattern, dualism, manichaeism, Armageddon. And it is very, very pronounced in the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, but only in the hard branches of them. And the hardest of the hard are the fundamentalists. Right now, after 11 September, we see very clearly two fundamentalisms at work. So they both operate that way. The two parties, one is evil.
Today our nation saw evil.
We are good.
And we responded with the best of America.
And the battle is inevitable.
We have now no choice. So we will act. And our determination in acting is total.
I think, however, there is another point which is more subtle. And that is the dehumanization of the other as a person without a cause. These are rebels without a cause. They have only one cause. And that's to be evil.
It is perpetrated by fanatics who are utterly indifferent to the sanctity of human life.
So you then come, of course, to the conclusion that the only way out is to crush them.
And eradicate this evil completely from our world.
If you come to that conclusion, And you can bolster it by the argument that arguments won't make any sense, and to sit down and talk with them makes no sense because they have no other cause than evil. Then you have essentially reduced them to bacteria, to microorganisms. And you make use of the same approach as is done when we try to approach microorganisms with antibiotica. Seek and destroy.
If you want to exercise so much violence against an opponent, if you want to use so many weapons and so many bombs and throw so many daisy cutters and kill in the process so many innocent civilians as you always do, you need to have a very strong moral justification.
I want him held. I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
And the best moral justification is indeed to describe the opponent as the absolute evil, because the only way in which you deal with absolute evil is only through military means. You also need to make people believe that you're no longer dealing with human beings, because for most people around the world, I mean, we are an aggressive species, that's certainly true, but most of us don't kill each other. But it's very easy to make people kill each other. Once you make people believe that the opponent deserves to be eliminated because the opponent is evil, the opponent poses a fundamental threat to your own welfare. And moreover, the opponent isn't really human. That's why you always see these references to inhuman beings. Like, for example, during the Second World War, Nazi propaganda would describe Jews as rats. Now, something like that happened, for example, during the Gulf War, when the Iraqis were described as cockroaches. You've just got to kill them. It's vermin. Eliminate them. And that's the most powerful, I think, tool that propaganda can deploy. That is the spreading of what I'd like to call the elimination belief. See, the normal people, in many situations, like, for example, in the Second World War, many Jews were killed by ordinary German citizens, ordinary men and women. Same thing happened in the Balkan countries. The same thing that happens all over again. And that only is possible when you make people, through very effective propaganda, believe, you know, that others deserve to be killed.
Today our nation saw evil.
This
evil,
mass terrorism,
I fear no evil,
is the new evil in our world today.
Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil.
Mud sticks. If you continually say the same thing, maybe you say it in different ways, like a lawyer, you'll actually start to build a case for, let's say, an invasion. If we start to look at what is now happening in terms of Iraq, the Americans are now sort of pulling out, saying their work in Afghanistan has been done. And already they're on phase two, which is building a consensus against Saddam Hussein. Now, the man may be a very, very bad bugger who needs to be replaced by his own people, but actually starting to build up stories that are not very easy to prove or disprove about biological weapons, chemical weapons, dirty bombs or uranium bombs, or all these kind of things is starting to influence public opinion, so public opinion will not be upset when there's a huge, great army ready to move in to Iraq. Are they actually expecting to go into Baghdad and topple the regime? Baghdad's a long way away from the borders, so that's going to be, you know, a very, very, very bloody campaign that will kill a lot of people. To do that, they've actually got to really demonize not just Saddam Hussein, but the Iraqi people, because there will be Iraqi people who will be killed. People should be aware and should be just spotting stories that have been, not say planted or manufactured, but start to see how the mood is changing.
You've got those who have an interest in describing reality in a certain way, to create a certain definition of reality in which Saddam Hussein, you know, is a bastard and in which he is no good and in which Osama bin Laden needs to be killed. That's a definition of reality. We deal with an extremely dangerous situation. We deal with terrorism. The reality will be defined in such a way. Now, of course, in order to bring that message to people at large, to your audiences, because this is, you know, one of the problems in any kind of democratic arrangement, that you need to have sort of, you know, like the moral high ground, you need to have sort of a constituency to support you. It's much easier to go to war in a totalitarian state. You don't have to ask all these citizens, you know. So there you have a problem, because citizens, you know, you can never really trust them. So you've got to manipulate them. You've got to make them believe that this is all right. Now, there's intermediaries, and that's maybe corporate interests. There's probably oil interests. There's military interests. There's arms sales. There's all these things. And then you have people at large who probably, by and large, know all would just want to live in a peaceful world and wouldn't want to necessarily go out and kill people they've never seen before. You've got to say that there is always a certain level of dissent, you know, even within the way in which you frame reality. I mean, during the Kosovo War, there were always people who said, but is this a wise idea, and should you throw bombs, and maybe you kill innocent people, and so on and so forth. That's the kind of criticism within the frame. Now, once people step outside the frame, as, you know, as characters like Noam Chomsky do all the time, but they're considered to be very nasty characters because they're very upsetting, because they say maybe the frame isn't right. Maybe the definition of reality isn't right. Maybe it's about something totally different. Now, why do people, by and large, not react to that in a relieved way, as if they would say, oh, great, now we know if reality is more complicated. Good, you know, I want to hear more about what Chomsky has to say. But of course, because, and again, one can understand, it's very disconcerting, it's very disquieting. It's very nice to believe, you know, that there's awful things happening in Kosovo, and that NATO is going to stop that, you know. They're going to end there with force, you know, they're going to bomb these people into accepting human rights as a standard for the way in which they conduct themselves. And we're going to go after the bastards, you know, who kill people in the Twin Towers. That's a nice, simple scheme. That's nice, you know, it's nice. It's black and white, it's right and wrong, you know, it's very clear. And of course, most people want to conduct their lives with fairly simple schemes, because life is difficult enough for most people, I mean, to get through. Life is a complex proposition for most people.
You're saying this is a war, and in previous wars there has been censorship. You're saying that type of thing is not now under consideration at the White House?
Keith, that is not censorship. This is a request to the media, and media makes their own decisions. Larry?
Just wondering, is this request only to American media and therefore the American public, or are you saying, you know, that you wish media all around the world would stop?
Well, I reported to you what Dr. Rice did in a phone call this morning,
okay,
and so you have that.
I'm
getting there.
Okay.
And so I reported that information about what Dr. Rice did, in fact, pick up a phone and ask for this morning among the people she called.
How forceful has the government been in trying to keep the media in line?
Media analyst Steve Rendell.
You do have Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor. You have Ari Fleischer, the President's Press Secretary, and several other people from the Bush administration coming out and warning the news media, and that seems to have had an effect. I mean, as if the news media wasn't already very much in gear with the White House line, Ari Fleischer came out and said, Americans should watch what they say, watch what they do. Now, that was quite shocking to a lot of Americans, but the reaction it got from a lot of the big corporate media was quite different. A lot of Americans said, how dare he say that to us? How dare he? Now, what was the reaction at CNN? Walter Isaacson, the president of CNN and formerly the editor of Time magazine, came out and said, whenever we do a story about civilian casualties, we've got to remind viewers what happened on September 11th. I mean, it's not only a shameful caving in to the White House, it's also an absolute disrespect for CNN viewers. So, in fact, what CNN has done ever since Walter Isaacson put that memo out to all of the reporters and producers under him, what they've done every time they mention a civilian casualty in Afghanistan, they'll generally show video footage of September 11th. And this is a complete acquiescence to the White House agenda. So there's been a profound effect, because not only because of their natural predilection, the corporate mainstream media in the United States has a natural predilection to go along with that, whatever the official agenda is, but in case they got any idea of having an occasional dissenting point of view or doing a story that might not put the United States government in the best light, well, you know, the White House came out and said, you know, you've got to watch what you say, watch what you do. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, called a meeting, had a phone conference meeting with the presidents of all the major networks. And it wasn't for news. It wasn't a news conference. It was to tell them what the U.S. government would like to see from them.
There had been a lot of very improper contact between government and the press.
Free speech campaigner Peter Norlander.
These have all been in the form of more or less informal approaches where, for example, the UK government has had a meeting with BBC, ITV people just to discuss, quote-unquote, the way that issues of terrorism are covered. The United States government has actually also tried to interfere with the way that foreign stations cover issues of terrorism and cover specifically anything related to Osama bin Laden, in that the sense that they actually approached the country in which Al Jazeera is based, Al Jazeera being the main Arab language satellite news station, and they tried to get the government there to rein in, as it were, Al Jazeera, because they thought that Al Jazeera's reporting on anything related to bin Laden was quite inflammatory, and they tried to get the government there to actually hold back Al Jazeera's coverage. These are really very, very, very improper attempts to interfere with freedom of expression.
Good afternoon. It was a year ago today that the global war on terrorism began, when U.S. and coalition forces commenced military operations in and over Afghanistan.
One of the reasons that Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, conducts daily Pentagon briefings, where before that would generally be done by some spokesperson for the Pentagon, is because he wants complete control of the message and of any information that could come out. And he's been very, very unforthcoming and has not given very much information at all to, and in fact, quite deceptive. I mean, he's said, for instance, that this is, you know, this is the most precise war ever. There's been less collateral damage, fewer civilian casualties, which is ironic because he tells us he can't tell us how many civilian casualties there are, and then he says there's been less than ever before, which is untrue. I mean, there are independent groups that have studied this, but the U.S. government has been very tight-lipped about a lot of the information since September 11th.
Access to government health information has now become quite problematic, particularly in countries such as the UK, where there's a fledgling sort of freedom of information law that is only just about to be implemented, and where a lot of information now is still being accessed through informal government arrangements. That has certainly tightened up. In the United States, the Freedom of Information Act is now also being applied more strictly as a result of this USA Patriot Act that was enacted by Congress just after the 11th of September. Also, there is far less willingness among officials to actually release information on the grounds that to release it would be damaging to national security. Now, of course, the officer, the public official who makes this decision autonomously. He's the one that makes that decision, and it's, on the whole, it's not going to be reviewed. So it's very much the point of view of one public official in this department who think it's going to be damaging to national security, and that is the be-all and end-all of it.
The United States government for the last several years has been trying to privatize public information. Presidential papers are being withheld. George Bush, the current president, is trying to privatize and put his own personal papers off limits. This is the same trend that we're seeing now, where the U.S. government has bought up all the satellite photography of Afghanistan and of Central Asia that's being done. Why is that being done? It's being done to deny access to the U.S. and international press to those same pictures.
Well, that's what you call information management. It's one of the leading techniques also in propaganda. You know, you just make certain that you select and filter whatever you want your audience to see. Of course, there's been an awful lot of imagery. It couldn't be any different because all these satellites have been taking all these photos, so there must be an enormous amount of material. But once, of course, you know, you are not certain whether that serves your purposes, then you simply censor it away. Either, you know, because the satellites are government operated, or you make certain that the commercial satellites don't sell the imagery to the press. Now, to some extent, you know, you must wonder whether that is a wise strategy, whether it would have made any real difference. I remember from the Gulf War when the Bush administration announced that it would go into the ground war because there were massive Iraqi troops getting together close to the border of Iraq, and there was a real danger, you know. The satellite imagery at that time showed that there were no Iraqi troops close to the Saudi border, and yet it made no difference for the world press. They still, you know, believed that there were massive Iraqi troops, although they could see with their own eyes that they weren't there.
February 19th, 2002. The New York Times reports that the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence is developing plans to provide news items possibly even false ones, to foreign media organizations, in an effort to influence public sentiment and policymakers in both friendly and unfriendly countries. The Pentagon hired the Rendon Group, an international communications firm, to help with the new office. 1 week later, the New York Times reports, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has disbanded the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence. The Rendon Group, however, still works for the American government.
If you want to have a message out effectively as a government, I mean, it makes sense that you turn to the professionals who know how to do this, and who know how to do this for commercial reasons, so they could probably also do this for other reasons. And so this is precisely what happened, for example, during the Gulf War, when one of the major international public relations firms, Hill & Knowlton, was engaged by the Bush administration. I think they got something like a $10 million or so, which is not an awful lot of money, but still enough, you know, for them to create stories, like the story about the Kuwaiti nurse who saw the Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of the incubators and killed them, which is totally untrue. The story about the birds in the Gulf region who were the victims of Saddam Hussein's, you know, putting fire to the oil fields. There's a large number of stories that come up all the time, and for which you need indeed professionals to do that, and PR agencies just apparently now allow themselves to find that morally acceptable and just do that.
When you take this Hill & Knowlton, which was the name of the press agency that was hired by the Kuwaiti side and which was then hired afterwards in Yugoslavia together with other agencies, if you look at that, what they do, of course, is to add to the evil on the other side by making stories of that kind. And this was done during the First World War, it was done in the Crimean War, it's an old thing, and would add to the propaganda. And of course it would also entirely neglect the evil done by one's own side, like for instance the killing of civilians. And here there is some kind of fighting over the numbers in that connection. There are major factors. The incubator story went all over the world. Didn't seem to damage Hill & Knowlton the slightest, even if it was pointed out that it was a blatant lie. I myself had contact with Hill & Knowlton, and I was told that our task is to train and to teach our clients how to get their message across. Our task is not to test and check the veracity of their message, but we could tell that person how to present the message on television. And it was very well presented. Our task was not to go into Kuwait to find the truth about incubators. Well, one can see it. One can understand it. It's terrible. And the terrible thing about it is not that Hill & Knowlton does this. The terrible thing about it is that media give them space. So evidently they're very effective. It has been reported that about 40% of foreign news in the United States has an origin of that kind. In other words, it comes from public relations organizations. So it means you can buy your image.
Well, it's very convenient, isn't it? Because, you know, and it's of course totally against the very structure of any democratic arrangement, in which the crucial concept, of course, is public accountability. But of course, you know, if you're going to tell lies to people, if you're going to use black, grey, and other types of propaganda, you know, you're not likely to want to be very accountable for that. And in a way, it's a nice trick to have these things all, you know, be executed by private agencies. So but the private agency doesn't have any public accountability. There will be no parliamentary kind of investigation into Hill & Knowlton. And the government, of course, can always claim that, yes, you know, they engaged an agency, but they want to really distance themselves from the agency because they just went really overboard, you know, they did things, you know, that they never intended to do. And, of course, they can always claim they never really knew.
What amazes me, in a certain sense, is not that people are gullible once and twice and three times, but that they are gullible four times, five times, six times. That's a little bit surprising. That people don't simply learn not to trust a single word of what comes out from those kinds of quarters. Well, that'll probably come, and when it comes, it'll come like an avalanche of distrust, where lots of babies will be thrown out with the dishwater. In other words, you can imagine situations where not a single word from a foreign minister and ministry will be believed. And that's also going a little bit too far.
It's always being said that in a war, the first casualty is the truth. But of course, immediately related to that is that the second casualty is the desire to be told the truth. Many people don't want to hear. And for example, now we know that during the Gulf War, when people were asked about the Pentagon censorship in the USA and in the UK, a majority of people said they thought it was quite all right. They didn't want to hear what happened. No one can claim today that you could know about what the reality behind the Gulf War or Kosovo or Afghanistan really was. You could, because there's so much information available. I mean, there is alternative news services around the world. There's an alternative international news agency, Interpress Service, which reports very differently about these matters from AP or Reuters or Agence France-Presse. There's, of course, an enormous amount of information on the Internet. The trouble, of course, is, again, it's complicated because it implies you've got to spend time. My point of view would be, well, that's part of wanting to live in a democracy. See, democracy is not an easy system. It comes with a price. It comes with a lot of active involvement by the citizens. Now, if you don't want that, then apparently you don't want to have a democracy. Well, then go to a totalitarian state. Then you don't have to think. People will think for you. Most people, you know, would be very happy with the way in which Walter Cronkite always did it at the end, you know, of his newscasting. He would always say, and that's the way it is. That's nice to live. You can go on with your own business because now you know how it is. You don't want to be told the truth. Also because of the truth is really unsettling. I mean, if you were to believe that your own government, you know, is complicit in killing of innocent civilians who should not be killed and who are killed for the wrong reasons, that's very difficult, because then also, why is that upsetting? Because then also, you know, it would be by implication be your moral duty to do something about it.
You've been listening to The Producers, part of the Sound Fountain series War of Words, compiled and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Thanks go to Norwegian peace activist Johan Galtung, Dutch professor Sees Hamelink, American media analyst Steve Rendall, from London, free speech campaigner Peter Norlander, and media trainer Alan Davis.
The series continues next week with The Cutting Room, Corporate Media in Times of Conflict. This is a Radio Netherlands presentation.
And we'll bring you more of that Radio Netherlands series on propaganda in future editions of Unwelcome Guests. Grant Wakefield is the producer of The Fire This Time, the documentary we're about to hear next. Wakefield said he knew very little about Iraq until 4 years ago. He only remembered watching the coverage of the 1991 Gulf War with unease, thinking that it was the fuse for World War III. Then it was over. In the words of a British newsreader, quote, "That was a report on the casualties of the war, but let's just move away from that and on to some sports news," close quote. Wakefield's co-writer of the documentary is journalist Miriam Ryle, who was among the first Westerners to visit post-war Iraq. In 1994, she made a documentary about the terrible conditions there called Voices from Iraq. Only one station in the whole of Europe, and none in the U.S., would show Miriam's film at the time. Such was the resistance to the information in conventional broadcasting circles. In 1998, Ryle lent Wakefield a book by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. It was called The Fire This Time, and was a savage indictment of the U.S.-led bombing of Iraq. It affected Wakefield profoundly. In April 1999, he and Ryle traveled to Iraq intending to update her documentary. As well as broadcast-quality footage of life in and around Baghdad, they shot several key interviews, including one with the new United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, Hans von Sponeck. Von Sponeck, a UN diplomat of 32 years' experience, had been in charge of the UN's entire program in Iraq for 6 months at that time. In an exclusive interview, he went on record for the first time to say that he, too, had come to believe that the sanctions experiment was over and furthermore to accuse Britain and America of manipulating the sanctions to their own agenda and at the cost of Iraq's civilian population. Upon their return to Britain, they offered the footage unedited to both the BBC and Channel 4. BBC World's response to von Sponeck's interview was, "We do not accept rant pieces." Channel 4 News' only and utterly absurd question was, "Did you film any executions?" Wakefield said they were too shocked to think to say yes. "We had indeed filmed executions," he said, "in Iraqi hospitals, dozens of examples of the estimated 5,000 children that die every month in Iraq as a direct result of sanctions." Another broadcaster told them, "Oh no, we couldn't possibly take anything from freelancers. Well, perhaps if you'd made a fluffy little film about people living in the mountains, maybe we could have taken that." With a wealth of material from both 1994 and 1999, but largely prevented by mainstream media from ever showing it, Wakefield put the idea to Ryle, why not make an audio CD? Thus, the Fire This Time audio project was born. It was my sincere hope that the CD would be a permanent record of the fate of Iraq, a guide to the language of mainstream propaganda, and a warning for the future. The two questions at its heart were simple. When would this lunacy ever end, and who would be next? Those were the words of Grant Wakefield, maker of the audio documentary you're about to hear, The Fire This Time.
In 1985, at the height of the Iran-Iraq war, all-round American patriot Colonel Oliver North met with Iranian businessmen in a hotel room in Frankfurt.
"One of the things that we would like to do, okay, is we would like to become actively engaged in ending this war in such a way that it becomes very evident to everybody that the real problem in preventing peace in the region is Saddam Hussein, and we'll act to take care of that."
In the prelude to the Gulf War, it was easy to think that Iraq had only just been invented, that there was nothing much to say about it as a country, that there was nothing much there to bomb. In fact, the history being arranged for us was played out in the land where all written history began. For whilst Europe was populated with Stone Age tribes, the people of Mesopotamia were living in towns, and those towns had libraries. The city of Babylon flourished for 2,000 years, changing hands as rival empires fought over trade routes, riches, land. It was here a legal code was written, that the strong might not oppress the weak. 20 centuries before the birth of Christ, these laws had distinguished justice from revenge. Centuries later, another great city was built, capital of the Arab Empire and its new religion, Islam. Rhymed poetry, geometry, our number system, all come from Baghdad. Here, in Europe's Dark Age, Arab scholars calculated the circumference of the earth. 6 centuries later, the church conceded it was not flat. The crusades launched against Islam did not reach Baghdad. By the time the Europeans came, the Christian nations had colonized the globe. Who, the Africans asked, has not seen the simpering grey men with their flags? In World War I, the Ottoman Empire was defeated and the Allies moved in. With a League of Nations mandate, the region was divided between French and British rule. Palestine was declared a Jewish homeland. A line in the sand made Kuwait a state, but Kurdish dreams of nationhood were less convenient. Having promised self-rule, Britain occupied Iraq and stayed there. Resistance was discouraged with bombs and mustard gas. When independence finally came in 1932, power was handed to a puppet king, Western companies had just begun to export Iraq's oil.
But across the map to Iraq, another danger spot that Britain dealt with before it was too late.
Iraq, 1941. Saddam Hussein is four, born into the cauldron of post-colonial rule. Iraq is still the prisoner of the West's will.
After World War II, Europe needed American loans to rebuild. A World Bank was founded, and the League of Nations replaced.
We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind.
But the Security Council, controlled by the Allies, was deadlocked in superpower rivalries. Policy advisors set out Washington's goals.
We have about 60% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in this position is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this disparity. We should cease to talk about such vague and unreal objectives as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization.
In 1958, there was a revolution in Iraq. The new prime minister, Abdel Kassim, began to nationalize the oil fields. "We are fighting," he declared, "for the industrialization of our republic and an end to our dependence on the sale of crude oil." Washington had other plans, deciding that the opposition Ba'ath Party was
the political force of the future.
The CIA met with activists, including Saddam Hussein. In the coup that followed, thousands were arrested, tortured, and killed. Kassim himself
suffered a terminal illness before a firing squad.
But in 1972, the Ba'ath government nationalized Iraq's oil. OPEC was wresting control from the West. As prices rose, America threatened to invade the Gulf, prompting Kuwait and Saudi Arabia to mine their oil fields. But since a clash with the Soviets was inadvisable, more discreet methods of management were found. Working with the Shah of Iran, the CIA funneled weapons to Kurdish rebels in Iraq. Neither government wished the Kurds to win the war that followed.
They merely hoped to ensure a level of hostilities high enough to sap the resources of Iraq.
Baghdad conceded to Iranian border demands. The Shah closed the frontier to the rebels. American aid was withdrawn, and the Kurds forced to surrender.
"Covert actions,"
Kissinger explained,
"should not be confused with missionary work."
Repression intensified as Iraq moved towards dictatorship, but Western companies vied for business as the Ba'ath Party began to spend. Oil revenues were invested in the country and a modern infrastructure built. Roads, hospitals, clean water, power. Food was subsidized, healthcare and education free. Kassim's vision of an independent nation was within reach. In 1977, Senator Henry Jackson's report to the Natural Resources Committee advised that
"the defense of the oil resources of the Gulf constitutes one of the most vital and enduring interests of the United States."
Iran had provided a cover for American influence, but that was about to change. In 1979, the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah Khomeini swept to power in an Islamic revolution. Tensions flared as he denounced America and the new president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. After months of border skirmishes, Iraq invaded. Years of bloody trench warfare followed. Iran attacked with human waves of soldiers, some as young as 14, and Iraq used chemical weapons. But despite an international arms ban, Britain, France, and both superpowers supplied military equipment to the Iraqi regime.
"Since Saddam Hussein was aligned against Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranians, we gave him everything."
A nervous Kuwait and Saudi Arabia bankrolled Iraq throughout the war, and the US bombed Iranian ships and oil platforms. But America was also sending arms to Iran. In 1988, the Iranians captured the Kurdish town of Halabja. Iraq counterattacked with nerve gas, and 5,000 people were killed. exiled Kurds staged a hunger strike at the UN to draw attention to this atrocity, but no vital or enduring interest was shown. The following year, America sold Iraq raw materials for chemical weapons, and Britain sponsored an arms fair in Baghdad. The West, as Britain's defense minister acknowledged, had been
well served by Iran and Iraq fighting each other.
By the time the war ended, 800,000 young men were dead, and Iraq, which had started the war with reserves of $30 billion, was now $80 billion in debt. One day after the ceasefire, Kuwait announced plans to increase oil exports in defiance of OPEC quotas. The price of crude began to slide. In June 1989, they stepped up production again. Iraq was hard hit.
For every fall of a dollar in the price of a barrel of oil, Iraq lost $1 billion in income.
Whilst Iraq was at war, Kuwait had moved into the Rumalia oil field, shifting a border disputed since colonial times. In November, Kuwaiti officials met with the CIA and agreed
to take advantage of the deteriorating economic situation in Iraq, to put pressure on that country's government to delineate our common border. The CIA gave us its view of appropriate means of pressure.
As oil prices collapsed, Kuwait demanded that Iraq repay its wartime debts. In December, the United States invaded Panama without rebuke from the UN Security Council. The Soviet Empire was in chaos, the global pattern of relationships changing. US War Plan 1002, devised to counter a Russian threat in the Gulf, was updated and now posed Iraq as the enemy. Early in 1990, General Norman Schwarzkopf briefed Congress.
Middle East oil is the West's lifeblood. It is going to fuel us when the rest of the world has run dry.
Schwarzkopf advocated a permanent US presence in the Gulf. But in the wake of Soviet collapse, there were calls to cut military spending. New enemies had to be found. A white paper was drawn up which identified Iraq and Saddam Hussein as
the optimum contenders to replace the Warsaw Pact.
There was just one problem. According to the US Army War College,
Baghdad should not be expected to deliberately provoke military confrontations with anyone.
US intelligence indicated that Iraq's desire was to reduce the army and repay their debts. But high unemployment made demobilization impossible. Inflation on the dinar was 40% and rising, and the price of oil continued to fall. In May 1990, Saddam Hussein protested at Kuwait's continuing overproduction.
Were it possible, we would have endured, but I say that we have reached a point where we can no longer withstand pressure.
The Kuwaitis were dismissive, as an American official recalled.
When the Iraqis came and said, "Can't you do something about it?" the Kuwaitis said, "Sit on it." And they didn't even say it nicely. They were arrogant. They were terrible.
Charles Allen, the CIA's officer for warning, predicted that Iraq would invade Kuwait. His report was shelved. In a diplomatic offensive, Iraq sent envoys to Arab states until Kuwait agreed to a summit. On July 10th, new quotas were settled. On the 11th, Kuwait rejected them and announced plans to further increase production by October. Saddam Hussein's patience was exhausted.
I think he came to believe that Kuwait was overproducing oil, not in its own interest, but because it was goaded into that by the United States in an effort to weaken Iraq.
On July 15th, Iraq wrote to the Arab League and the UN Secretary General, listing their grievances. On the 17th, Saddam Hussein accused Kuwait of economic warfare. On the 18th, troops were sent to the border. Saddam Hussein summoned US Ambassador Glaspie and asked her to clarify the American position.
I have direct instructions from the President to seek better relations with Iraq. Our opinion is you should have the opportunity to rebuild your country, but we have no opinion on Arab-Arab conflicts like your border disagreement with Kuwait.
As the crisis escalated, King Hussein of Jordan went to Kuwait to try and broker a compromise, to be told,
"We are not going to respond. If they don't like it, let them occupy our territory. We are going to bring in the Americans."
As Iraqi forces moved to the front line, the Assistant Secretary of State was questioned in Congress.
"If Iraq, for example, charged across the border into Kuwait, is it correct to say that we do not have a treaty commitment which would oblige us to engage U.S. forces?" "That is correct."
On the 2nd of August, Iraq invaded.
Everyone, it seems, from the ordinary Kuwaiti in the street to the sophisticated planners in the Pentagon, was taken by surprise by Saddam Hussein's strike at his tiny neighbor.
"Brutal aggression launched last night against Kuwait illustrates my central thesis. The world remains a dangerous place with serious threats to important U.S. interests."
President Bush convened an emergency session of the Security Council. The invasion was condemned, sanctions levied, and Iraq's assets frozen the following day.
"Iraq was to suffer economic isolation and intense hardship until it relented. It was perhaps the most complete blockade of a country seen in recent times."
The US State Department then sent a message to the countries of the Arab League.
"The West has done its duty, but the Arab nations are doing nothing. If they do not take a firm stand on the Kuwaiti affair, they can be sure that in the future they will no longer be able to count on America."
With the world united, hopes were high that the Security Council would now be an effective force for peace.
"Mr. President, this is a far more important issue than simply the invasion of Kuwait. This is, in its own way, the first real test of this new world order that we're trying to put together."
But U.S. officials were pushing to get troops into the Gulf.
The administration turned to Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States.
Producing satellite photographs, they claimed that Iraqi troops were heading for the Saudi border and could attack within 48 hours. Permission was granted to base U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. In fact, 40,000 troops were already on their way. Now warplanes were sent to join them.
"I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government in the defense of its homeland."
Bush told Congress that 120,000 Iraqi troops had moved toward the Saudi border. DIA analysts, who saw Soviet satellite pictures, later commented,
"We didn't see anything to indicate an Iraqi force in Kuwait of even 20% the size the administration claimed."
U.S. intelligence reported that troops were in fact pulling back into southern Iraq.
"Saddam might well have not intended to invade Saudi Arabia, but there must have been great temptation. It was a period of great vulnerability.
Unless you can get into Saudi Arabia and for our Israel and for the world."
In mid-August, three Iraqi peace proposals were made. The third was welcomed in a statement by the Saudis, urging Kuwait to negotiate. 2 days later, the Saudis retracted it, as Air Force Chief of Staff Michael Dugan assured the press that
"We are positive for a joint attack."
"Initially, the deployment of American and other forces after the invasion was simply defensive. The President was quite chief, General Norman Schwarzkopf, ruled out any attempt to recover Kuwait by force."
In the meantime, resolutions flowed from the Security Council. A blockade was sanctioned. Dependent on imported food, Iraq now faced starvation. On September 4th, James Baker said that U.S. gold now included the destruction of Iraq's military. On September 15th, Dugan said targets would include
"What is unique about Iraqi culture, that they put very high value on, that psychologically would make an impact.
If push came to shove, the cutting edge would be downtown Baghdad. If I want to hurt you, it would be at home, not out in the woods someplace."
Over 100,000 troops were now stationed in the Gulf, without congressional debate or authority, and the build-up continued.
"In the biggest operation since World War II, Western equipment and troops have been landing at the Saudi port of Jubail, less than 200 miles from Kuwait.
questions were asked.
Why should the West defend a country which has no democracy?
When he was gassing his own Kurdish people, when he was invading Iran, where were all the clever politicians then?
And answers given.
The president's stated reasons vary, from upholding international law to protecting oil fields, putting down a new hit,
I don't believe
improving regional security, and saving
the concern in the region is purely and simply oil. Our jobs, our way of life, our own freedom would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of that one man, Saddam Hussein.
We made him what he is.
So it isn't energy sanctions.
Mr. Elliott spelled it out. It's
all about hope.
Just wait.
I
watch and learn.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
The president repeated the incubator story six times in his verbal war against Saddam.
Had kids in incubators and they were thrown out.
300 babies had died, the president said. But the girl who gave the testimony
wasn't just a simple Kuwaiti escapee. In fact, just a few seats away was her father, Kuwait's ambassador to the United States and Canada.
A fact known to the organizers of the hearing.
Citizens for a Free Kuwait wanted to get public opinion behind a full-scale commitment, so they paid over $10 million to America's biggest public relations company, Hill & Knowlton, Inc.
Which is about what it is for a presidential campaign.
Most ordinary Americans didn't care about Kuwait.
So the efforts were, what is it that we can do to emotionally motivate people to support actions through the UN to drive them out? Saddam's power will only grow. The next conflict will find him stronger still, perhaps in possession even of nuclear weapons.
Many still opposed the war, and Congress had not voted. They were
willing to have a vote as long as the outcome was more or less certain to be supportive of the administration.
Bush doubled the troops to 400,000.
I know in my heart of hearts that what we are doing is right, 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 right.
Unable to count on the support of Congress, the administration turned to the United Nations.
If we could get the Soviet Union to agree to the use of force, China would not veto. It was decided that I would visit with each and every government on the Security Council.
Debts were written off. Loans granted to China, Russia, Israel, Iran. Incentives totaling $23 billion. Resolution 678 authorized the use of
all necessary means to restore international peace and security in the area.
It is at this stage quite impossible to determine in detail precisely what that may mean.
This is a very bad precedent for the Security Council. Who knows who's next in line?
Will those in favor of the draft resolution please raise their hands?
China abstained, and Yemen and Cuba actually voted against the resolution.
Thank you. The draft resolution has been adopted as resolution 678.
The next day, all U.S. aid to Yemen was cancelled.
Secretary, thank you for bringing us very closely in contact with these realities.
This meeting is adjourned.
The United Nations can now play the kind of role that we all have hoped for a long time it could play.
Iraq was given until January 15th to withdraw.
I have today directed the Secretary of Defense to increase the size of U.S. forces to ensure that the coalition has an adequate offensive military option.
Sent in the early days of the crisis to defend Saudi Arabia, it began to look as if they might be used to attack Iraq.
Across the world, people demonstrated as the Allies readied for an assault.
If there is an ideal time for war in the desert, it's before March, but that drastically shortens the time for sanctions to bite.
Were
Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz and the US Secretary of State James Baker met in Geneva.
To go the extra mile for peace.
Bush wrote a letter to Saddam Hussein.
He read the letter, didn't say a word. And then he looked at me and he said, I cannot accept this letter.
When it comes to the Arabs, there you raise the stick.
With 4 days to go, the Senate voted.
On this vote, the yeas are 52 and the nays are 47.
This will not be another Vietnam. We will not permit our troops to have their hands tied behind their backs. And I pledge to you, there will not be any murky ending.